Welcome to Churchdown Podcast. I'm your host, Samantha.
I'm James.
And I'm Gary.
We're audio engineers, authors, and educators.
With a special focus on houses of worship.
On this episode, balance and gain structure.
A special shout out to this show's sponsors. First up, we have Electro Voice, who have been a leader in church sound since the beginning, and today offers the industry's largest portfolio of loudspeaker system solutions for houses of worship of all sizes. Elevate the audio experience with Electro Voice.
We also want to thank Digico. Their new Quantum 852 and other House of Worship solutions are available at digico.biz. Hey, we have an Instagram now. Hey.
Whoa.
I know. It's like we're sneaking our way into the 2020s. you can find us there at Church Sound Podcast. So no underscores, no dots, no, hey, it's me, Church Sound Podcast. Mm-hmm. It's just Church Sound Podcast.
All one word.
All one word. So lately, Gary and Samantha, you guys have been around the block a time or two. And
or three.
Yeah, we'll give you a third lap, Gary. So, you know, we talk often about our training philosophy and kind of the way that we, you know, think about what to do for all of that. Quickly, like kind of what's your big picture? Like if you had to say sound was boiled down to one thing, what would you say what it is?
Oof.
Yeah. One thing?
Gosh. If doing sound is down to one thing.
Gosh, my one thing is too encompassing, and that would be, you know, saying the fundamentals. And knowing kind of where you're going with this, James, in that you've led us into this, you know, I would say gain is a very, very important part. If you don't get started right, it's never going to get right.
I'm going with balance. Everything that we do boils down to balance. If we like ignore amplification, it's balance.
Yeah. I'd say that's a great way to go for this episode today. Mm. You know, I've been trying to think about like, how do we categorize all the training things that we do? Cause I'm always teaching people. I'm like, what's most important? Where do you, you know, does everybody need to learn how to do system tuning? And should we get everybody certified on SMART if they're ever going to volunteer at a church? I'm like, that's a little excessive. Mm-hmm. So I've boiled it down to a big picture outline, and let me run it by you guys, and you can tear it apart and tell me I'm terrible, or, you know, laud me with praise, whatever you want to do.
Sounds good.
Either one, your choice. So big picture outline. We've got our foundation. We've got then four pillars on that foundation and then three finishing touches. Okay, so follow me here. In the foundation, we've got system design, right? Where the speakers are pointed, all that. System tuning and then console layout, right? That's kind of like your basic stuff. You know, like if you get all that set up, you're going to have an easier time doing the rest of the stuff. We have four pillars, right? There's getting the sound source right. There's capturing the source well. Then there's balance and gain structure. That's one pillar altogether. And then using your high pass filter and low pass filter. Mm-hmm. If you're curious, the three finishing touches are EQ, compression, and effects. But today we're really just going to narrow it down and talk about gain structure. So we're talking about turning it up and down. We're talking about balancing it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to lead off and ask, so now what's your philosophy for where you set your preamp, right? So do you go like, you know, full DBFS, you know, like as much headroom or as little headroom as you can to capture as many bits as possible? Or are you mixing with your preamps to balance faders at zero? Do you do some kind of hybrid thing with trim? Like what's kind of the go-to philosophy for if you're setting up a board, you're getting sound check done for maybe the first time, setting up a bass scene for somebody? What's your philosophy there?
Mine is, and always will be, getting my metering, my preamp levels so that the signal is kissing yellow, or it's like, you know, about what, negative 12-ish, or negative 16 LUFS, I think is what the number is. But everybody's color scheme follows the same concept. So kissing yellow is, for me, the optimum place to put it. That is what is optimum suggested, you know, nominal. That is what's nominal. And then I can use my faders for really, really minute movements where they are the most granular, which is around unity. If the levels are out of whack after that, it's because the amplifiers or something else is wrong downstream of it. But if I can get the preamps kissing yellow and my faders around unity, that's most nominal.
What about you, Gary? What's your go-to method for how do you set your preamp?
Yeah, you know, it's evolved and changed a little bit over the past years when we switched from analog to digital. You know, back in the analog days, for me, it was all about get your gain up front, you know, because you're going to introduce noise down the line. And as, you know, older analog consoles, that was, you know, definitely the case. It was pretty easy. You start moving stuff around post gain and you're introducing noise. In the digital world, I don't stress about it as much, but I am much like Samantha in that I like to, you know, kind of kiss up against that orange or yellow light there and, you know, get my gain set, you know, solid up front there. The only time I find myself deviating from that is usually like my senior pastor's mic or something, because if I get my gain where it's at, my fader always ends up well below unity. And then I'm like, oh, I make a little move, you know, because the fader not being linear, the farther down you have the fader, you move it and all of a sudden, boy, that's a 10 dB jump, you know, kind of thing. So sometimes I will take my senior pastor's mic and have the gain down a little bit or, you know, whatever is necessary so I can be at unity. So again, my fader movements are much more smoother right around that 0 plus 5 plus 10 and minus 5 minus 10.
Yeah, that's kind of the sweet spot for where faders like to live. You know, it's like a millimeter there is really, you know, maybe half a dB, maybe three quarters of a dB. Whereas, you know, a millimeter down by negative 20 might be 2 or 3 dB, which, you know, if you're trying to fine tune stuff, that's a big deal.
Well, what about you, James?
Well, I'm often just kind of like running and gunning, so to speak, where I'm like, you know, I throw up whatever mix is already happening. People are doing their thing and like, you know, usually monitors are already going by the time they're playing. Like I very rarely have like a formal sound check where I'm like, you know, one instrument at a time, we set the preamp and then we go from there. It's usually set up kind of roughed in and I'm just kind of like, oh, do I need this a little bit down? And if so, I'm going to wait till they're like in between songs. And maybe that's just a bad habit of mine where I don't like stop and be like, everybody wait, we got to do a live, you know, a real sound check.
Yeah.
I'm just like, yeah, y'all do your thing. If there's a problem, I'll tell you and we'll get that. And because, you know, most of these churches, their monitoring systems are probably in-ear monitor systems that are personal mixers. Mm-hmm. So if you go messing around with gain after they're started, that can, you know, mess stuff up. But yeah. I will give people a heads up always and be like, hey, I'm going to change this. I have done it before. Like if I'm getting really clinical and I really want to like get stuff dialed in, I've done a hybrid system where I will turn up the gain or the preamp till it's like optimal with enough headroom, you know, that yellowish area. Mm-hmm. And then if my fader needs to be in a much different place from what it needs to be with that, I've used the digital trim before to like trim that down so that my fader can come right up to zero. But I've also like just this morning, I was at my kids' school, like trying to help them ring out the choir mics for their upcoming concert. Mm. And I found like, you know, kind of Gary, what you're saying about like, you know, in the analog world, if you don't get your preamp hot enough, you're going to end up amplifying noise later on down the road. Right. But with digital, it's less of a problem. But here, they actually had their preamp down at like plus 5, which is, I think, is about as low as it can go. And they were turning it up with their digital trim a whole lot. Mm. And that was actually creating more noise and hiss than when we swapped it. You know, we turned down the digital trim, we turned up the preamp, mm-hmm. and it got noticeably less hiss out of these admittedly kind of hissy choir mics to begin with. Mm-hmm. But we made an improvement by, you know, making sure that we were turning it up with the preamp hitting the AD converter before messing with the digital trim or using makeup gain on the, you know, compressor's output and stuff like that. So that was a long way to say I kind of flip-flop and I'm kind of like less persnickety, but I will like give people a heads up and be like, hey, yeah. I need more gain on this. So y'all turn that down.
Yeah, I'll give people a warning too, because I do also do the rip and run where it's like, I need to make changes. That because it's like the first thing I always do is like, I assume the person who did this last messed it up. Like, that's my assumption. And so I'll just go through while they're playing again, hopefully not. My first time mixing them is not at the start of service, but just going really quickly and saying, hey, FYI, I'm changing some things, so it's going to make your ears weird, and making the adjustments without having to do a line-by-line check, right? And I kind of actually prefer that, because when you do the single instrument at a time, they're not playing authentically.
Nope.
They're just, right. They're like hit, 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 or strum, strum, or sing, whatever. They're not playing how they really are. When they're actually playing all together, that's as close as you could possibly get to the real thing, because it basically is. So I actually prefer that.
Yeah, no, that's great. Now, you know, a great point that we should, you know, make here is gain affects more than what you're probably hearing out of your loudspeakers, you know, in the mix in the room. Like, you know, once I get my gain set, it's got to be pretty radical for me to go try and fix it after I've set it up, because I could be affecting, you know, depending on how the system is set up, the broadcast guy's gain, the mm-hmm. in-ears, you know, the feeds that are going elsewhere. So, you know, getting gain set and then, you know, kind of leaving it, I think is critical as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, another, just for to say it a third time, after the service starts, do not mess with the gain with the preamps unless it is an absolute emergency. Like they're clipping to death or something like that. Just because there's so many things downstream of it you're affecting. Just don't touch it.
Yeah. I would include an emergency as like a singer getting way louder during service and then mm-hmm. they're actually clipping.
Yeah.
And in those kinds of situations, like you think about like, you know, I want to turn the gain down because it's clipping, but then you think I shouldn't turn down the gain because then it's going to affect everybody else. But then you think again, like, but if I don't turn it down, it's already too loud for everybody else. So I'm mm-hmm. actually doing everybody a favor by trimming it down a little bit.
Yeah.
And so yeah, that's the point where like, I will call that an emergency if someone suddenly or unexpectedly gets louder and it's clipping even a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. because they have that extra bit of energy, we're going to make everybody else's mix work by dialing that preamp back a couple dB, you know, like we're not going drastic here. You know, we're still keeping it in the ballpark, but if they got louder, I'm going to turn you quieter and hopefully they don't blow their voice out and keep pushing harder because their monitor mix isn't right. But if they had sound check to fix that, that's their time to fix that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got the ultimate new guy story back when I was first starting mixing of we're in sound check and I'm still messing around with my gains and didn't fully understand the whole concept of gain. But I was, you know, so smart because I'd studied up on compressors and gates and all that type of stuff. And all of a sudden I'm like, why is my snare drum only coming through on certain hits and I see him hitting it and I'm not hearing it because I had gone back and adjusted my gain, which then messed up all of my gates on the drums and so forth. So yeah, there are ramifications to playing around with your gain after you have it set.
Yeah. Plus when we talk about like gain structure, right, there's so much more to gain structure than just the preamp level.
Yes.
As we've already noted, there's a digital trim. There's the fader is technically a part of that. Any dynamics processing we're using, those have an effect on gain structure, as does EQ. Like basically any point along the chain that can affect the level of a signal is considered part of the gain structure. And there's a you know, how it's phrased is that there's a nominal way to do it. In other words, there's a way that we can set it up so that the electronics are having as little impact on the sound or the signal rather as possible. And so that's whenever you see a like a zero or like a special hash mark or something like that, or a U for unity, when you see those marks, that is what is considered nominal, like the suggested area to hang out around. Of course, like that's not real life and we swing in any other direction, but the idea behind it is that if we set up the preamp correctly, we set up our faders to hang around unity and everything along the chain is at its nominal level, it will be as clean and transparent having come in as it is going out as it can possibly be managed. That's what we aim for. Some people want to color it. Some people like certain consoles or certain preamps because they color the signal. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people don't want that. But when we talk gain structure, there are many stops along the chain, starting at like wireless microphones. Gary, you said that. Starting at the wireless mic, you know, that it has its own little internal preamp. And then we've got the preamp at the console all the way through to the amplifiers connected to the loudspeakers.
Yeah, 100% correct. And getting the chain and everything working properly is, you know, to me, again, it's so important. And like, and we'll say it for probably the fifth time now of, you know, it's kind of one of those things of you want to get your gain structure set so that you don't have to mess with it, you know, later on.
So when we're starting to balance our mix, all right, so, you know, imagine we've gone through and everything has good gain. You know, everybody's hitting the yellow in the loud parts. When you're balancing your mix, so this is less of the technical stuff, but like when you're building a mix from scratch, what's the first input that you will push up?
You go for it, Gary.
I'm sitting there thinking of, are you talking the channel input?
Yes, which channel? Like, yeah, I
always kind of start with my drums. You know, I build my mix around my drums. I don't know if that's because, you know, my joke of, you know, on a good day, I'm a drummer. I'd, you know, stay percussionist. That implies talent. You know, that could be where it comes from. But I really like to get the foundation of my mix together right away. And so drums and bass to me are kind of that critical starting point and getting that foundation. So that's where I will start, you know, building from, is what for me always the left side of my console when I lay it out. You know, my kick drum's always, you know, now with layers, it's a little different, but you know, back in the day when, you know, you're mixing on a 56 channel desk, I mean, drums are always on the left and vocals were always, you know, all the way on the right. I always, you know, laid my desk out that way. And I found in the digital world, you know, my kick drum's always on channel one of that level. And depending on how many channels are in that level, my vocals are like on, you know, 8 through 12 on a different level, but they're always, again, back towards, you know, the center of the desk.
It depends on what kind of a job I'm doing, but let's say we're, you know, for the sake of the name of the podcast, it's a worship. So, I outside secularly, I'll do the same thing, Gary. I'll start with drums because everything's kind of building off of that, and getting those balanced is not only a super nuanced job that I want to make sure I'm paying enough attention to, that becomes much harder to do when everything else is playing. So I like to get that done. But when I'm in houses of worship, especially if I've only got a little bit of time to get things going, I've started recently just doing vocals first and getting those lined up. Huh. Because if those are right, then like I can fudge the rest of it, but those have to be spot on as quickly as possible. So in that case, I go vocals, and then I'll scooch other stuff out of the way and then start building it back up. So I may like, okay, vocals are good. Backup vocals are good. Okay, get everybody else scooch, scooch, scooch. And like not mute you, not take the levels all the way down, but just go on, get out of the way right now. And kind of build it like almost backwards. I do them inversely to each other, right? So secularly, I'm going from drums to rhythm to harmonies and melodies to vocals. And then I kind of do it backwards for when I'm in worship. It's just, I'm doing vocals and then melodies and then harmonies and rhythm and maybe drums last. Sometimes I'll kind of, you know, mix it up. If the drummer's super, super good, it's fun to throw them in there early, but not every drummer is, you know, the best.
So. Not every drummer is a percussionist, as I can tell you.
Now, I like to start usually with the worship leader's instrument. And so then I can turn up their vocal and have it mm-hmm. in some sort of context.
Yeah, yeah.
I do appreciate having the vocal up early and making sure that that's clear. Because again, you know, it's what people are singing along with, right? We want to make sure that there's no problems there. But after I've got the vocal, like the lead vocal and the primary instrument, usually mm-hmm. the worship leader's instrument, up, then I'll start adding like bass and kick drum. And then from there, I'll go from like kick drum to snare and then add in my other rhythm instruments and like subdivision kind of things after I've got that, to make sure that I'm not overwhelming the vocal, you know, with when I'm pushing other stuff up. And then everybody's kind of got like their cousin, so to speak, as they're, you know, we're pushing up inputs, mm-hmm. you know, like the bass is the low end of the primary instrument. And then the kick drum is the punch of the low end that the bass is sustaining. And then the snare and the kick, they kind of go together. And then overheads, we're going to just be, we're going to be a little timid with the overheads at first because you never know when the drummer's going to get excited and bash much harder.
Taste. Yep.
Yeah. a friend of mine quoted some other drummer he saw on Instagram that was like, beat the drums, pet the cymbals. Okay. So all of y'all have permission to tell your drummers that beat the drums, pet the cymbals, and everything will sound better. So yeah, I'm kind of more of like, kind of top down, but kind of bottom up at the same time. Yeah, I'm all over the place, but but I've got a method for it, and it's helpful for especially when I'm having new people shadow me. They can watch and be like, "Oh, this is how this is supposed to relate to that thing, mm-hmm. And this is how this is supposed to, you know, stick together." It helps me get those relationships right, and then it also, like, if I've got my foundation for my bass and my drums up, and I've got my primary instrument and my vocal. When I'm mixing the other instruments in, I can push those up to like I can hear them and then kind of back them off a little bit to make sure that they're not overcoming the lead vocal a little bit. Mm. So that's kind of my order of operations when it comes to balancing a mix.
Yeah.
I like trying new stuff all the time. So it might be different next week.
Right. So when you guys do dynamics processing, do you use the gain knob on it or the makeup gain, as it's sometimes noted? Do you guys use that or do you just let the compressor mush?
Yeah, no, I commonly, definitely on vocals, I'll use makeup gain. I'll usually try to bring, you know, I'll try to, if you will, flatten it out and then bring that level back up. But primarily I only use makeup gain on vocals. Occasionally, if like the acoustic guitar is the big rhythm instrument that morning or something, I might do a little makeup gain on the acoustic, but mm-hmm. you know, for me, it's pretty much vocals.
Yeah. What about you, James?
Yeah. I, you know, if I'm a little more clinical that day and I've got my faders closer to -5, 0, whatever, and I haven't applied compression yet, I'll keep my finger on the fader while I lower the threshold so mm-hmm. that I can go ahead and push up any gain that I'm missing, so to speak, so that I can hear when it's like, you know, when you apply compression and it's in context, you're basically making it quieter. So then it kind of pushes it back in the mix.
Yeah.
I want to still be able to hear what the compression is doing so that I know when I've hit that point of going too far. Mm-hmm. So I'll push up the fader while I'm lowering the threshold. And when I think I've got about the right amount of gain reduction, then I will use my makeup gain to like look at my fader. And if my fader's at like +6, I'll just dial up 6 dB of makeup gain on my compressor and pull mm-hmm. my fader back 6 dB.
Sure.
That way I'm I know I'm kind of in the ballpark of like, if I have to bypass this compressor, or if I'm afraid this compressor is like making things worse rather than better, I bypass it. And then the general average level doesn't shift all that much, whether that's in or out.
Yeah. I just remembered, as you said it, that you can take a compressor out in the middle of mixing. I have never done that. I exclaimed when you said that. I was like, oh my gosh, that's right. Like, yeah, like if you decide, yeah, I don't feel like doing this compressor anymore in the middle of your mix, crazy decision, but something could be happening that requires you to do that. That if you do that, make sure it's not such a drastic level change that it's either so much higher or so much lower that you're like, you've blown up your own mix. I, again, completely forgot that that was a button you could even push. once then, I'm like, I've committed to this. it's for me, I'm still aiming to keep that, like, it around that, like, sort of kissing yellow, the, what is it, if we're on full scale, not lifts, if we're on full scale units. I think I said lifts earlier, so asterisk correction here, but if we're on the full scale, like negative 16 ish I think, or kissing yellow, or negative 12 if you're not on a full scale fader, but I like staying near there. So if I'm compressing it a lot, I'm compressing something for consistency for the most part. Sometimes, you know, we use compression artistically, and sometimes we use it purely for a control point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I put it on a bass, I'm putting it on bass for consistency, because especially as a bass player, I know that that's one of our best tools is a compressor, because unless we're picking, it can be really inconsistent between notes, between fingers, between strings. It can just change a lot. So a compressor helps with that. Additionally, also adding some grit, but that's a different episode.
That's artistic. Yes.
Yeah. But then like that, I'm aiming for consistency, but it is a little bit artistic, but then there are times when it's a vocalist doesn't have very good control, or they're leaning in and out a lot. And I'm using compression to kind of make up for that fact, so I don't have to do, I have to do slightly less fader writing. Yeah. So with the makeup gain, it's a way for me to, again, to like hit that sort of nominal kind of level, and I like what you said, James, like sort of keeping an eye on how the compressor actually sounds, because mm-hmm. sometimes this is one of those, we can kind of make an argument on how much preamps this day and age have an effect on signal. There is an argument to be had there on how much it affects it. One that is, you know, unequivocally changing how things sound is a compressor, because dynamics processing is nonlinear. So it's like, in other words, like always changing. And everybody's compression algorithm between digital desks or hardware gear is different. And so, like, I don't like the way that an Exynet M32 compressor sounds. If you like start driving it too hard, I don't like how it sounds. So sometimes just taking it out is better. Some desks I like more, or others, like it's really, you could actually hear that making a change on it. So if ever you're like, gosh, this thing sounds kind of wonky, but I don't understand why it would, try removing the dynamics processing or starting fresh on the dynamics processing. So gates, compressors, things like that.
So when you're in a more complex system, and there's monitors, front of house, and broadcast, maybe even recording, mm-hmm. all using the same preamps, how do you go about like communicating with other people and what their needs are? How do you, like, what are some workarounds you've used? Like, if monitors needs more preamp on the drums than front of house does, what are some of the things that you guys do to kind of patch that, to make sure that you're, you know, being a good team player and everybody has what they need?
Since everything's so like a digital split now, it feels like it matters less. So I'll make it nominal, right? So we get enough headroom for everybody. And because we're doing a digital split, then everybody has their own digital gain. So that, it, you know, only one person usually there in Dante circumstances, there's actually multiple people who have control over a preamp. But I don't, you don't, that's not always like that. So I have the one person who's in charge of the preamp, and we're assuming that they're making, like if I'm doing it, making it as nominal as possible, make sure there's plenty of headroom and we're not introducing any extra noise. Then when they get the digital split, they can do whatever they want with the digital gain. And that's a, I don't know, did we talk about digital trim at all very much in this episode yet? We brought it up a few times, but.
Yeah, it's been mentioned, but it hasn't. We haven't really given that. So
yeah, what's the difference between a preamp and a digital trim, y'all?
So the preamp is actually an analog gain stage that happens before the signal gets converted to a digital signal at the analog to digital converter. Mm-hmm. So the analog to digital converter is kind of like your digital camera, and the preamp is kind of like your zoom lens, right? If you zoom in too far with your zoom lens and you cut off your subject's head, there's no getting that back, right? There's no amount of Photoshop. Mm-hmm. Maybe AI could do it, but we're not there with our consoles yet, right? So we've got to capture the signal level within what that sensor can do on our analog to digital converter. And so the preamp is turning it up in the analog domain before it gets there. Digital trim is kind of like zooming in digitally after you've captured a picture. So eventually it'll get pixelated, but you can still punch in on it and have plenty of resolution there. Mm-hmm. If we're going to get really nerdy, and there are some people that will like really nerd out on this stuff, 16-bit resolution audio, which is what our CDs are. Right. If you guys remember those discs,
remember compact discs?
If you guys remember those, that was like the first jump into mass distributed digital audio, and it was at 16-bit. Now we're most stuff is at 24-bit, and some is even at 32-bit float, which is like super nerdy and beyond my pay scale. But the 24-bit has like 16 million levels of resolution, where 16-bit had like 65,000, somewhere like that. Mm-hmm. So if you get up to negative 48 on your DBFS meter in 24-bit, you've already surpassed all of the levels of bits that you had at 16-bit. So there's our nerd corner for today. But that's kind of like the difference between preamp and digital trim. Digital trim is after the analog to digital converter, and it can only go up so much before you get artifacts. Whereas the analog preamp, if you clip the analog preamp, there's no fixing
clipped.
That.
It's clipped.
It's gone.
Yeah. So yeah, digital trim. You'll see this if on your consoles you can swap between like say something like a Dante input or an AES input and the analog stuff on the back of the console. You should see a change in how you can control that area. So like on the Allen Heath consoles. If it's an analog preamp, an analog preamp controls pop up. So preamp can gain like a bunch of stuff. But if you do just including a phantom power, actually also. But if you do a digital input, it's already been converted, right? It's digital. So you'll get very simple controls, which is often referred to as just the digital trim. As James said, it's sort of like a secondary control level. So if the preamp is set correctly, the digital trim should be more than enough for anybody else doing anything. It varies from desk to desk how far up or down the digital trim actually moves. But it's usually, again, plenty. So back to the initial question is, how do we set it up for other people using the system? I mean, you make it as nominal as you can at the analog stage. And then when it gets converted into digital, everybody, here you go. If you want to push it down because you want to have your faders up higher, be my guest. But I'm going to make sure the analog piece of it is as good as possible.
Yeah, very, very well said. James, I love your illustration of the camera in the zoom because that is, to me, speaks to it very clear. You can never add the top part of the shot back in, but you can zoom in on it But if you're zoomed out way too far, when you zoom in, you're going to get noise. So that, to me, that's a beautiful, beautiful illustration.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. The other thing I was thinking about in this situation is the times when you need more, like many of the churches that I'm, you know, helping out, they have personal monitor mixers, but to get enough level for usually the drummers for them to hear themselves well, sometimes I need more level at the preamp for that than I do for what I need on my front of house mix. So one thing that I've done on occasion to kind of help that is actually just using a DCA or a digitally controlled amplifier. And then I can like just go ahead and park my drums DCA at like negative 10. And that'll keep my faders closer to zero or unity while giving plenty of level for the drummer to, you know, crank it up and destroy their own hearing. But hey, that's, you know, that's not my problem to solve. But if they need more and they get more, you know, that's one way that I've kind of made everybody happy.
Yeah, I'll just turn everything else down. Just like, oh, okay, if you need more, I mean, I'm giving her all she's got. So I guess you're having, I'll take these other 15 faders and bring them down in your ears. And then you can, back to your point, crank them up in your own ears and there's the level you need. So.
Yeah, this is a bit tangential, but it is still related to gain. You know, I don't know how many times I've walked up on stage with a musician and they're like, I can't hear myself in my ears, you know? And yeah, I listen to their mix and I'm like, well, of course you can't because you have every fader at full. And, you know, and they may even at that point have the master gain turned way down, but they still have like all the other faders, you know, pretty much of it full. And again, it's a gain structure issue, you know, to go back and say, okay, let's back all this down and let's build it, you know, one at a time. Mm-hmm. And there's so many times that, again, a musician isn't necessarily completely understand audio and how it works. And so they have, in essence, by the use of their own personal monitor, really messed up the gain structure there. And doing a reset and going back often will completely clear that up. And hopefully, well, definitely will protect their ears as well.
Yeah, musicians, God bless them. They're just not monitor engineers, right? Like that's why monitor engineering is such a, it is its own job. Like it is their magic sort of touch that gets things balanced in a musician's ears. So I that's why I kind of like personal monitor mixers. It's a double-edged sword. Yeah. So we give them the power, like you can build whatever you need and you can make adjustments at any point. You don't have to flag anybody down. But also if you like left their own devices, oftentimes they just crank everything up all of the way. And then they're like, yeah, I'm just having a really hard time hearing anything. And yeah, Gary, like they just hurting themselves. Everything's just on 10 and they don't understand that the absence of certain things could mean at the end more of something else. And that's really that if there's one lesson about monitors to be said, it is that sometimes less is more. So having less of one thing means you'll be able to hear something else because there's only so much sonic space we can kind of take up before things start getting really muddy. It's not like we don't have like an infinite ability to hear and comprehend like a ton of vibrating air molecules. We can only do so much. So you have to pick and choose. Like, I know that you may really like the harmonica, but it's when we have the harmonica up too high, like you're missing the cue from the organ. So, you know, what do we do here?
Well, you know, on that same thing, I'll say as a front of house engineer, oftentimes I will find myself listening to a mix and I'm like, why are certain things not coming out or why am I not hearing this? And, you know, your first reaction is, oh, you know, I will turn it up. And more times than not, I'll be like, oh, it's that synth pad that I've got that's eating up the same space as the vocal space or, you know, whatever it is. And for me, it's always usually somewhere in the low mids where I'm like, why is this mix just not punchy?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm like, well, I'll just make the kick drum a little louder and that'll give me a little more attack and punch. And I find now more and more, I'll listen way more critically and go, what's competing down here? Let's take out some of the things that aren't there. And so, you know, using at this point the gain of my fader, you know, I'm going to pull back that synth pad. And I'm like, oh, well, that was going on. That's what was masking what I was really looking for.
Yep. Yeah. Fader creep is a real thing that I think it's easy to suffer from. So once I see like my like master outputs are at a level that I think is good, like I'll typically keep my master fader like at about -6 or so, just to give myself a little wiggle room to push it up and down as needed. But once I get that level like good, you can't just keep pushing the faders up. Like it doesn't, again, there is a finite amount of stuff going on here. So it becomes a game of, okay, I'm struggling to hear the snare as much on this. So what do I have to move out of the way so I can hear it? Cause I can't just keep pushing it up, which is something you see a lot of newbies do as well. It's fader creep. You'll see it in the studio. You'll see it doing it live. You just keep cranking it up. So
I call it the ratchet effect, where it's like a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. Mm-hmm. It's like, if you can't, I'll echo what y'all have said. If you can't hear something, find something to turn down rather than something to turn up.
Yeah.
Another thing that I find novice techs doing is, like, I'm back up a little bit. There's this thing that I call console fog, where when you're not behind the soundboard, you know exactly what's wrong and like what you would change. Sure. But as soon as you step behind the board, you're like,
this is more complex.
What do I touch? There's so many things. I have all the power. What do I touch first? You know? And so it can be a little overwhelming. Like, how loud should it be right now?
Yeah.
You know, when you're pushing up faders for the first time, let's say, you know, you are pushing up that, you know, primary worship leader's instrument during the first song to try to build your mix. And so one of the problems that I see new techs having is what I call dynamics mismatch, which is a fancy term for saying they're putting the faders in the wrong spot or the wrong overall level for the dynamics of the song. So, you know, like we're not just mixing like a mix that stays at one sonic level the entire time, right? The song has quiet and loud sections. And so we're not just aiming at like a single target for this is how loud the piano should be all the time. We have to think, how loud should the piano be at this point in the song? And is this point in the song a loud part of the song or a quiet part of the song? You know, getting a sound check started when the song is quieter can actually be more challenging because you don't know how much headroom you have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the band is going to get louder. There are going to be more instruments in just a minute. So what's the right level while it's quiet? I feel like that's one of the things that you have to kind of help people experience when you're training them.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to, it's just about having experienced it so many times. Or like if you're mixing for streaming, just like keeping your eye on the meters of just like, I logically know that this one instrument is going to be way less energy than 10 instruments. So let me just crank it way more than I feel it would be appropriate, knowing that this is not forever. Or it's just like, like, you know, sometimes, a lot of times, at least for the services I'm doing, here's like acoustic guitar or a piano playing underneath prayer. That doesn't need to be like 20 decibels up from its normal spot, but it needs to be something. Like the speaking or the speaker still needs to be way front and center. But yeah, it's all about just, I've done this 500 times. So I just know that I need to crank it. And you can learn that if you don't have somebody to help guide you by doing things like recording it, or if you're streaming, going back and watch and listening to it again, that'll show you like, oh, this is way quieter than I thought it was going to be. So I can be more liberal with my level next time around.
Yeah, absolutely. And boy, there's a huge difference. You know, we talked about monitors being an art in it of itself, you know, and knowing how to help musicians and getting them to hear what they need to hear. But broadcast also, because there's, you know, in my vernacular, there's so much less headroom in broadcasting, you know, than when I'm mixing live, I've got live dynamics going on. So I'm limited by my PA.
Yeah, you like want the dynamics live.
But in broadcast, you're limited by how much energy, you know, you're going to send out of that desk.
Yeah. And like the variation is way tinier because when you have a live performance, you're like, 20 decibel of dynamics. Great. It's about emotion. There's so much to it. But when we talk about streaming, it's like, I'll give you 5 at most.
Yes.
And that would be a lot. There's it's a really complex topic to talk about that. We've had a couple episodes on here. There's one or two I did about like streaming level and things like that, that we're just barely scraping the idea because it does get complex quickly. But yeah, the goal is to just have it as little variance in level as we possibly can when we're streaming and doing things of that nature.
Yeah, I find, back to our kind of preamp conversation, though, is like broadcast techs tend to want to have a lot more level coming into their digital audio workstation if they're mixing with plugins, because a lot of the plugins are kind of suited to have nominal being quite a bit higher, because they figure that if you're in the studio and you have the time to really dial in your sounds and you're being really, you know, careful about your levels, you're going to want a really hot level coming into that to really make some of those plugins really, you know, find their sweet spot in their dynamic range, especially with like, you know, analog emulations of compressors. So, you know, really pushing the levels for a broadcast might be better if you're using those kinds of plugins, where again, in live, you know, like it's kind of like a rodeo out there. We're just kind of like trying to make sure that we don't clip and leave in plenty of headroom. So there's kind of a different even philosophy of, you know, where our input levels want to be. And so that's where, again, the digital trim can be really helpful for those times for broadcast mixers and front of house mixers to get along. I think I'm good on this one. Do you guys have any other thoughts you want to add before we wrap it up?
I think I'm good.
Good.
Cool.
All right. Whose turn? Should we make Gary do it? Oh, no, my bad, James.
Oh, I can go ahead. Cool. So if you found this podcast helpful and want to help us reach more church sound techs, tech directors, and worship leaders, would you take a moment and leave a rating and a review wherever you're listening to this podcast? Just a couple minutes goes a long way to help us reach more church sound techs.
Church Sound Podcast is part of the ProSound Web Podcast Network. I'm Samantha Potter.
I'm James Attaway.
And I'm Gary Zanstra.
Thanks for tuning in and have an amazing service this week.